Well, hello everybody. Today I'd like to welcome Dr. Tammy Ingram to the show. Tammy is an historian who publishes on Southern politics, crime, and punishment. She received her PhD from Yale University and is currently an associate professor in history, urban studies, women's and gender studies, and crime law and society at the College of Charleston. She has also held positions as the Kirk Visiting Professor at Agnes Scott College in Atlanta, the Center for the Study of the American South at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the Gilder Lehrman Center and the Department of History at Yale University. Her first book, Dixie Highway, Road Building and the Making of the American South, received awards from the Georgia Historical Society, the Georgia Historical Records Advisory Council, and the Business History Conference. Today we'll be discussing her forthcoming book, The Wickedest City in America, The Violent Reign of Organized Crime in the Jim Crow South. Well, all right, let's welcome Tammy to the show. Tammy, welcome so much to the show. It's great to have you on.
Well, thank you, Keith. I appreciate you inviting me on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, okay, now, so here's the thing. Your book, your new book that's coming out sometime in the future here, The Wickedest City in America, The Rise and Fall of Organized Crime in the Jim Crow South. I've got the abstracts here. I've read through all the, you know, the chapter descriptions and everything. And it's a book about organized crime in Phoenix City, Alabama, in the sort of first half of the 20th century, let's put it that way. And I was reading through the work, and I'm like, what the hell is going on here? Why is it that I don't know about this story? This is my home state, okay? I'm from Alabama. I'm from Birmingham. I didn't grow up there. I grew up on the West Coast. As everybody knows, I consider myself a Westerner, a California kid, because I grew up here. But I was born in Alabama, and I have connections back there. I've still got family in Alabama, and I think about Alabama. I have an Alabama Roll Tide hat hanging on my hat rack back here. So I've got, you know, I'm an Alabama kid for sure. And I'm reading through this. I'm going, why is it that I don't know about this? This completely just kind of threw me off guard. And you say in the 1950s, this was the most infamous city in America, and I don't know anything about it. What gives?
Yeah. Andy? Well, these are all fair questions. Mm-hmm. It was infamous, the most infamous city in America for a very short period of time. My book begins and ends with a murder in 1954 of a fairly well-known politician in Alabama named Albert Patterson, who was had just won the Democratic primary to become the new Attorney General for the state of Alabama, which, of course, for all of you familiar with Southern politics, that if you win in the Democratic primary is tantamount to winning the general election. Mm-hmm. So he was set to become the next Attorney General. But he's also before that, he'd been just an attorney in Phoenix City and had campaigned on a promise to clean up organized crime. So, of course, this wasn't very popular with the racketeers and the corrupt local officials who kept them in business. So Patterson was assassinated in June of 1954. Now, the few months that followed the murder were just a kind of whirlwind of activity that became known as the cleanup. Locals just call it the cleanup. After decades and decades of illegal criminal activity and corruption on the part of local law enforcement officials, judges, even some state officials were aware of this and declined to intervene to do anything to stop it. Suddenly, there's this flurry of activity. The state comes in, takes over the murder investigation. 100 and some odd people were indicted on over 700 different charges. The mob is shut down. And within 6 or 8 months, three people had been charged with the murder. Only one of them, the deputy sheriff, was actually convicted of the murder. And the case was tidied up. By the following summer, you have newspaper reporters coming back for the 1 year anniversary of the murder, just bragging about how the city has really turned itself around and is completely cleaned up. So to come back around to your question, it was in dominating headlines locally, regionally, nationally during that year, because it's just this crazy sounding scandalous story. But because the state and local officials were so eager to sweep it under the rug and to make this notoriety go away, they buttoned up the case very, very quickly, and everybody sort of moved on and forgot about it.
Fascinating. And, you know, and it really, it really blew me away to read about this. It's not so far from my hometown that this kind of stuff happened. And it must have struck you as interesting too. Now you're paving new ground here. Since we really don't know much about this story, what is it that compelled you to research and to write about this little city in Alabama?
Well, my initial interest in it had, I was finishing up my first book and I was looking for a new topic, but I really didn't conceive of this when I first stumbled upon the story as a second book project. I was teaching a course on film and Southern history, and someone told me that there was this really terrible B movie called The Phoenix City Story. And I couldn't believe that I'd never heard of it, because I knew where Phoenix City was because, like you, I grew up very near there. Mm-hmm. I actually grew up just a couple of hours south of Phoenix City on the Georgia line. For those of you who don't know that geography very well, and you wouldn't necessarily, these are tiny towns, Phoenix City sits on the western bank of the Chattahoochee River, which is the dividing line between the lower halves of Alabama and Georgia. So you could literally walk, you know, across the bridge from Phoenix City and be in Columbus, Georgia. So that's where you are. So I grew up on the Georgia side, just a couple of hours south of there. I knew where Phoenix City was. I'd heard of it, and I never heard of this story at all before. So of course I ran and tracked down a copy of the film and wanted to know more about this story so that I could teach the film to my students. So I just did a little bit of preliminary research to try to figure out what actually went on there, because I was convinced that this couldn't be true. That there's just no way this story was true, that it was some sort of wildly exaggerated story that had some small shred of truth in it, and the rest of it must be completely fabricated. But the deeper I dug into it, the more shocked I became at mm-hmm. how much it was was actually accurate. And so I decided that it would be a great topic for a book. But beyond that, more importantly, I really started to research this topic, I realized that here we are in the Jim Crow South, and I was teaching a seminars on crime and punishment, and everything I was reading, everything I was teaching, everything that I was having my students write about was about the criminalization of people of color. Mm-hmm. And you know, the condemnation of blackness, as Khalil Muhammad puts it. And there's this flurry of really wonderful scholarship in the last 10 years or so, of course, on this subject. But I was really fascinated with the other side of the story, which is the active conscious decriminalization of white people by those same officials. And so I thought that by looking at this very egregious example of white crime, it would be a really interesting way to think through the ways in which white people were decriminalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, for real. And you're anticipating like all of my questions. This is great. Because all of the stuff that I'm coming
Sorry.
Up with struck me as really interesting too, how you framed this work and the section on that I read on the, you know, historiography, how you talk about it, that so many scholars, and you mentioned Michelle Alexander's book, for example, The New Jim Crow, which talks a lot about the criminalization of Black people over this process. And of course, she focuses on incarceration and the justice systems and various things like that. But you really focus on how it is that kind of white people have essentially get off easy up until, you know, the mid-1950s, and sort of openly practice these things without a great deal of interference. One thing, and I'm going to get to that, but you brought up something a second ago that, and this is just, I'm coming from left field, has really nothing to do with your book, but an interesting point that you brought up is like looking for a new topic. I'm in the process of doing that too. And there's a lot of historians who listen to this show. Is that a struggle? Was that a struggle for you, you know, just sort of like feeling around for a new topic, or did you just sort of fall into it?
I really did just kind of fall into this one, which I think is the best way to do it. It found me. So mm-hmm. I know that's probably not very helpful to anybody who's like really struggling to find mm-hmm. something. But, you know, one thing that as I was thinking about a new book project, my first book was on about highway politics and the Dixie Highway. Yeah. And I did a lot of research on chain gangs. And so of course I had done a lot of reading about this topic and crime and punishment. I was really, you know, interested in the criminalization of African Americans in the early part of the 20th century. And I was thinking about sort of the historical legacies of that, and was interested in doing something, in a later period in the 20th century. So in a roundabout way, there are some connections between my first project and this one, but on the surface, they are really completely different. And that's part of what really appealed to me about this topic. So, I mean, I'm certainly not someone who's probably in a position to give advice to anybody about what they should do about second book projects necessarily. But I would say that I don't think there's any reason to be afraid of doing something in a that's very different, that diverges from work that you've already done. I think that's actually far more interesting. It's a lot more fun to do the research. And I think you bring to it a very different kind of perspective that really that serves you. I don't know. I mean, I think in this case, and I've heard plenty of my friends and colleagues have had similar things happen. What led me directly to this topic was not searching for a second book topic, but thinking about a course I really wanted to teach. And so something that I was lucky to get to be able to develop a new course on something that was really interesting to me. So sometimes you'll find these things in unexpected places.
Isn't that funny how that works out? Because I mean, I'm toying with the idea of writing about the Republican Party politics in the Reconstruction Civil War Reconstruction era in Southern California. Because Southern California was not particularly simpatico with the Republican Party during the Civil War and Reconstruction, and I sort of stumbled upon it because I was doing some research for a class that I'm teaching on Los Angeles history, and I spent a lot of time in cemeteries, and I find all these guys buried here. And you know, this is a totally roundabout random thing, but yeah, it just sort of like you're right, it falls into your lap, right? And so so that's kind of what I'm toying with right now. I'm still trying to figure out some of the questions that I'm asking, we'll see where that takes me. But anyway, you open the story in 54, like you said, with the murder of Albert Patterson, the gentleman who had just won the Democratic primary for Attorney General in Alabama. And of course, you mentioned that is a pretty significant accomplishment in terms of Alabama politics. Now, I don't want to give away the story because some of it, because you kind of give it away right in the beginning too. Who pulls the trigger here, and why is that important for us to understand?
All right, the person convicted who always said he didn't do it, of course, but the person convicted of actually pulling the trigger was the deputy sheriff, a guy named Albert Fuller, who was in cahoots with the rackets. He was deeply involved in one of the prostitution rings in Russell County, where Phoenix City is located, and was kind of their right-hand man. So the person who was accused of standing next to him as he pulled the trigger was the circuit solicitor. So the solicitor, basically the DA, whose name was Arch Farrell. Farrell was tried for murder, but he was acquitted and he was disbarred for other charges, some vote fraud charges. But years later, he got his law license back and continued to live and practice law in Phoenix City for the rest of his life. The third person who was accused of being involved, but also was not, was actually never tried. He checked himself into a mental hospital and died not too long thereafter, a few years after, was a guy named Silas Garrett, who was the outgoing attorney general of Alabama. His term was up and he couldn't run again. But he too was friendly with the racketeers and sort of helped them to get away with what they were doing. So three pretty powerful public officials were believed to be responsible for Patterson's murder.
And this to me is absolutely fascinating because it's not the gangsters that do the hit, I love gangster movies, right?
Me too.
and you always expect the gangsters are doing the hit, not necessarily the local officials. And this is something that I think is one of the key framing elements of your story here, is that the lines between the gangsters and the government, in local government, especially, this is important. Are the lines are really blurred here, and you note that this is really due in large part to the political culture of, I guess, the Jim Crow South at the time, right? These are state rights governments. These are local control governments. Having learned about Alabama politics, most of my life, this is something that comes up all the time. There's always that tension between local control and federal control. And here we have this little city that's dominated by local government in a state rights atmosphere. And because of this, as you point out, the organized crime kind of gets to flourish, mm-hmm. open in plain view of everyone. How does that work in this context?
Right, exactly right. Well, the reverence for local control and for state control and the absolute, zero tolerance for any sort of federal intervention whatsoever provided cover for illegal activities in towns like this and shielded them from any sort of prosecution. Now, there was another factor in Phoenix City that was important too, and which is that the town really had no industry, had no way to make any money. There were Columbus across the river was, of course, in the mid-19th century, had become a very wealthy cotton mill town. Mm-hmm. But a Supreme Court case determined in the 19th century that the river, the water rights, belonged to Georgia. And so on the Alabama side of the river, they couldn't set up any cotton mills and use the water to power the mills. So their fledgling textile industry just collapsed. And so the city really had no funds, and they were on the brink of bankruptcy by the 1930s. The town had always had this reputation for lawlessness, but it really became a kind of industry starting in the 1930s when local officials said, well, essentially if you can't beat them, join them, and began to issue business licenses to people who were, setting up legitimate looking businesses, restaurants, grocery stores that really did operate as restaurants out front, but had gambling rooms or saloons or other illegal activities in the back. Mm-hmm. Occasionally they would sweep in and, if people got upset and were complaining about illegal activity happening out in the open, they would sweep in and find someone and they'd be allowed to pay a fine and move on. There was really never any sort of serious punishment for this. But part of my argument is that this reverence for local control really persuaded a lot of local people to just go along with this and not to raise too much of a fuss, because as long as there was no violence, as long as it wasn't too out in the open, they were willing to live with it. It's also, this is a small town and these people all knew one another. So some people didn't like what was happening, but they didn't see it as being particularly dangerous, in part because the proprietors are fairly well-respected white men and women in the local community. The racketeers did a very good job of keeping a stranglehold on local government and keeping enough friends close at hand in the state capital in Montgomery, which is just about 80 miles to the west, to forestall any sort of, outside intervention that might threaten their operations. The one state official who could have easily stepped in at any time and shut down the rackets was the Attorney General. And so they were very keen on keeping a friendly face in that office. And so when, one of their own people, a local guy that they all knew, narrowly won that election and was threatening to shut them down, they really knew they were done for.
It struck me as interesting that the local citizenry seemed to buy into this. Now, what I know about Alabama is these are, God-fearing, Bible-belt conservatives, and yet they let this go on. And I guess it does get back to this idea that everyone knows each other. It's a small town, and if things aren't entirely out of hand, then why not just let mm-hmm. it go? I mean, it's a revenue generating industry. I imagine it employed mm-hmm. a significant portion of the community, and mm-hmm. so you know, you kind of turn the other way when these things are going down. So provided that they're not, you know, disrupting things too much. One of the, of course, the other thing, you know, that we should definitely bring up is all of this takes place in the context of Jim Crow segregation, right. Which was deeply entrenched in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s in Alabama. How does that inform your story?
Well, I think the most important way that Jim Crow functions the story, is that, of course, keeping Jim Crow intact also involved, maintaining a tight control over local government and state government, forestalling any sort of attempts from the federal government to intervene, even in some cases forestalling any attempts from the state to step in if local people did not want state intervention in a particular issue. So keeping these communities closed and very isolated and very insular was critical to the maintenance of Jim Crow segregation and allowing local governments and state governments to circumvent the constitutional rights of a large portion of the population. That exact same insularity also protected the racketeer. So while certainly in states that did not have Jim Crow governments, there was lawlessness. Of course, there was organized crime in other parts of the country. But I think it was so deeply entrenched and lasted for so long with really no real effort to shut it down. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation, no publicity either, right? We don't know about these stories. No one thinks of Alabama when they think of the mob or gangsters or mafia activity. And there are a lot of good reasons for that. And this is one of them. It was very hidden. It was very quiet. And I think that the sort of structure and function of Jim Crow governments is the main reason for that.
In the 1950s, by this point, the military had been desegregated by a presidential act. Truman did that, I think 47 or 48, I can't remember exactly the date, but the military had been desegregated. And right across the Chattahoochee River in Columbus there, of course, is Fort Benning, which, you know, a pretty significant military base there. And with the proximity of this military base, and the local populations being both Black and white, and the things that are going, all of these things combined must have made for some uncomfortable moments in regards to race relations. Were there anxieties about race mixing in Phoenix City? I mean, there surely must have been something going on. And how integrated was Fort Benning? Which is a question that I guess we should put on the table first.
Yeah, so the presence of Fort Benning is very important to this story, because although customers came from all over, Fort Benning really kept Phoenix City in business.
It's the military, and anybody who studies military history knows wherever armies go, you know, vice surely follows. Right?
The army base was great business for Phoenix City, and it was integrated. Black soldiers at that time would be in separate barracks at Fort Benning, but there certainly was racial tension in Columbus and racial tension on the base, but it was an integrated base. Phoenix City, however, is not an integrated town. Black soldiers did not go to the clubs and bars and brothels on 14th Street in Phoenix City. This is another one of the ways that the racketeers really shielded themselves. Now, if they had flouted the color line, if they had said, we're going to take, you know, we're going to allow Black soldiers to come into these businesses or, take their money, then local people probably would have been up in arms. But as long as they weren't, as I said earlier, it wasn't just the violence they were concerned about. As long as they were making sure that there's no one's crossing the color line, they were fairly comfortable with it. So there were a few clubs in one part of Russell County that were Black-only clubs, and Black soldiers could and sometimes did go there. Mm-hmm. But as far as I know, really, most of those businesses were the patrons were just local people. I don't think that they were relying so heavily on Black soldiers to go there. They'd have to travel a bit further to get to those, and leaving the base was probably a very fraught thing in those days for a lot of Black soldiers who would face a lot of resentment and tension from the white community. So,
sure, in the 1950s South, a Black man, uniformed Black man, essentially, you know, who's been trained to kill, and traveling around in the South would have been a particularly in the white South would have been a particularly dangerous move.
Right, especially if you're going into a neighboring community, you're a kid from, you know, outside the South or something, you're going to a neighboring community to have a drink. There's nothing in the minds of white Southerners, there's nothing harmless about that. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they, as best I can tell, I don't have any indication that they were frequent visitors to even the Black clubs, but they certainly were not allowed to go into any of the white businesses.
I just think it's fascinating that the local citizenry would look the other way when it came to, you know, racketeering and prostitution and illegal gambling and excessive drinking and all those types of things, but draw the line right. when it came to like integrated activities of any sort. That tells you a lot about the heart of Dixie. In
absolutely.
The 1950s.
Absolutely. Sure. I mean, right? Even ordinary you know, good people see the law itself is flexible, right? Mm-hmm. But the color line's not.
But the color line is absolutely rigid. That's 100% accurate statement there. You know, as historians, we often encounter, you know, looking through the archives, these heinous stories that kind of make us, you know, kind of like, you know, the WTF moment, right? It's like, whoa. That to me happened when I was reading through your work. I took pause when I read about the prostitution in this story and some of the and the way that sex workers are treated in this narrative, underage, the sort of almost. I guess you could say ownership in some cases of the various the clubs of the women who were in this occupation. I'm curious. I mean, I don't want to give too much away, but and I don't like spoilers, but you know, right, here we are, right? Were there any moments that sort of caught you off guard when you were doing the research? Things that you didn't expect, and you went, "Whoa, my God, what is this all about?"
Yes, you just mentioned one of them, and I'll mention that briefly and tell you about one other one. But the prostitution, it's no surprise, of course, that these racketeers would be engaged in prostitution. I was really stunned. I read newspaper articles and a couple of questionable books that referenced underage girls as young as maybe 12 years old, but I didn't know if that was just a rumor, I didn't know where any of this came from. But when I found some of the National Guard records, the National Guard was involved in the investigation and the cleanup in 1954. Mm-hmm. When I finally got my hands on some of the National Guard records that detail their interviews with some of the women who were involved in the prostitution rings and realized that that's actually true. There were quite a number of 12 and 13 and 14 year old girls who were taken by parents or guardians to some of the brothels and made to work there. That was disturbing to me. So was the confirmation in those same records that some women were branded with tattoos inside their mouths. I had never heard of such, I had no idea that was a thing, but it was, that was distressing. But the other story that I found, this is one of those that when I first read about it, I thought there's no way this can be true. And then I discovered that not only was it true, that the truth is actually worse than the rumor of it. There was also a black market adoption ring going on. So, and that was actually not run by an actual racketeer. And this speaks to the sort of pervasiveness of, you know, lawlessness in Phoenix City. It was actually run by a local doctor and his wife, who was his head nurse. They would check women into the hospital under the name of the adoptive mother, so there would be no paper trail. And they arranged everything. And always claimed later when they got caught, claimed that they didn't take any payment for their services, that they were just trying to do a good deed. But it was a pretty extensive operation that later became exposed, actually, because one of the mothers felt that she'd been duped and sued to get her child back. But I was stunned by that story. But as I began to dig into it, I discovered that similar things had actually happened in other states as well, in part because state adoption laws in those days, particularly in the South, were not very clear. And there were, of course, plenty of instances of kind of informal adoptions, but this was clearly a for-profit scheme that was being conducted by someone who had access to, you know, who could get, had access to the hospital officials and hospital records and could make sure there wouldn't be any paper trail.
That's amazing. Now, how do you, with them essentially erasing the paper trail, how is it that you discover that these things are actually going on? Is this somebody write down in the journal and lock it away? And, you know,
good question. I mean, that's a real challenge with a project like this, is that it's, you know, in my, my rule has been that if I can't find some sort of independent confirmation, obviously I'm not going to, there's one book written by a couple of newspaper editors who are a couple of journalists who were, are fantastic journalists who covered this story for newspapers in Birmingham. I trust their judgment completely, but they're also writing these kinds of, you know, sensational stories. And sometimes I think some of the stories might not be sourced so well, but in that, this is one of those stories that was in something they published. And I, but I, in digging around, discovered some Senate hearings in actually Estes Kefauver, who did the hearings on organized crime in 1950 and 1951. Mm-hmm. A few years later, also headed up the committee that investigated juvenile delinquency. And I stumbled upon these transcripts of those hearings. And the very first case they heard about juvenile delinquency was the case of the doctor and his wife in Phoenix City who were engaged in this scheme. And interestingly, the attorney who helped to bring them down was the son of Albert Patterson, who some people will recognize him. He later became the most, one of the more infamous governors of Alabama, John Patterson.
Yeah, and we'll talk about him for in a second for sure, because I do want to I definitely want to talk about John Patterson and the legacy here. But first, you've mentioned a couple of times this cleanup, the cleanup narrative that you bring up, and you sort of you advance the story forward to 2004. And when there's like, you know, some commemorative stuff going on, and you note that nobody really remembered the story of Phoenix City's sordid past. And then you say, and you suggest that this is really terrible if this has been erased. The stories of these horrible things that have happened and this pervasive crime has been erased. And what's the problem with, you know, kind of removing this? I mean, as historians, of course, we never want to, you know, do this on purpose, right? But the city certainly had an interest in getting rid of it because, you know, of course, it made them look bad. So what's the problem, you know, from a historian's perspective, what's the problem with erasing this?
Well, I mean, I think one of the biggest problems with it is that it has also taken with it this story of white decriminalization, which is incredibly important to our understanding of the history of crime and punishment. It's very important to our a fuller understanding of the effort that went into criminalizing people of color. And I think it's, you know, as we still grapple with this today, I think obviously the context has changed, but the same thing continues to happen. So I think it's timely. I think it's very relevant. And I think that going back and uncovering these stories will help us to understand how, you know, how this functioned in the past and how we can recognize it and push past it today. And, you know, I think one thing I do want to say about this particular example, you know, as I said earlier, I realize, you know, in focusing on a story like this, it's really sensational. And it's this extremely egregious instance of people violating the law and getting away with it. But I do think that one of the things I really want to, I hope this book will persuade people of, is that small town rackets are not outliers, really. We have this idea of the mob or the mafia that comports, you know, with the gangster movies that you and I really like. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we shouldn't, you know, just think about those famous examples in New York or Chicago, the Al Capones and those guys. It's, you know, racketeers and con men and corrupt police officers and judges and Underground economies have always flourished in smaller towns and smaller communities and continue to do so. So even if it doesn't constitute organized crime, we have plenty of examples of white criminal activity in which everyone from police officers to judges and juries exercise discretion in deciding what actually is worth pursuing, what constitutes, you know, really dangerous criminal activity, what deserves the attention of the state and of law enforcement officials, and what activities should the carceral state be focused on. And I think they've made some really interesting decisions about which of those things they focus on and which of those they don't. So I also think, against the backdrop of Jim Crow, looking at some of these really, you know, jaw-dropping stories like the sex trade and the illegal adoptions, helps us to see, point out more forcefully even the hypocrisy in some of the ways that Jim Crow justice was administered.
Absolutely. Now let's talk about law and order and the legacy of this story. You mentioned a minute ago John Patterson, who served one term as governor of Alabama, the late 50s, early 60s, and he very famously defeated George Wallace in that campaign. George Wallace, who, well, I guess infamously stated that he would never be out inward again. Is that a verb, inwarding? Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's the word we use here. That would never happen to him again. And then, of course, George Wallace, being, I guess you'd call him a populist, becomes like, you know, the segregationist voice of the South, you know, very, very famously so. And then, of course, carried that to his own presidential, his run for the presidency. This is Albert's son, you know, the person who opens your story with his murder. Now, John Patterson's a law and order guy. And we also talked about racialized ideas about crime. Clearly, he has some ideas here. How does this story of John Patterson and the legacy of this all kind of fit together?
This is a great question. And there's no easy answer to this, but I'll give it a shot. John Patterson's father, like him, was absolutely a segregationist. He also talked throughout his campaign about law and order, and you know, of course, going back to the war on crime under J. Edgar Hoover in the 1930s, this law and order, you know, was not something that's invented in this concept in the late 20th century, but it's something that's been with us that got sort of reshaped and redirected in the last quarter of the 20th century, and directed solely at African Americans or primarily at African Americans as a result of the war on drugs. But and obviously has this kind of political currency as well in the era of Wallace and Nixon. But John Patterson himself, I think, is actually a link to that period of transition in the 50s and 60s that kind of gets left out, really, I think, of a lot of histories of crime and punishment. We just sort of start with the 1960s and you know, assume that there's just this rise of law and order politicking that grows out of the aftermath of the civil rights movement and the student movements in the 1960s. But John Patterson himself did a very quick and interesting pivot on law and order when he, after the murder of his father, he took over his father's seat ran in a special election just weeks after his father was murdered to become the Attorney General of Alabama. Under Alabama law, high-ranking officials like that can only serve one term. So he used that as a launch pad to become governor. When he was running for governor, this is just 3 years after his father's been murdered. When he's running for governor, 3 or 4 years, running for governor, he's going around and talking about law and order and claiming that, you know, that there are people outside the state who are determined to do away with Alabama's way of life and defeat him, keep him from becoming governor so that they can threaten Alabama's way of life. And he said, you know, these are gangsters and the NAACP. So he makes this really, I mean, obviously he knows who killed his father. He ran that, his office ran that investigation and ran the trials. He's very well aware that the criminal element that he grew up around, that his father was fighting against, was all white. But and when his father campaigned for attorney general, he's talking about law and order in the context of cleaning up a white criminal organization. But Patterson himself made this very interesting switch to associate, you know, gangsterism, hoodlemism with the outside organizations like the NAACP, which of course he famously sued around the end of the time he was attorney general. I think the case went into his years as governor. He sued the NAACP to try to get them out of the state of Alabama because he said they were operating as an illegal business. So
I mean, in the you know, I see this. I mean, in the wake of the Brown decision and school desegregation and people being extraordinarily anxious about what was happening, I think, to their way of life, you know, put in quotation marks, that they always, you know, framed it as, looking at the NAACP as a subversive group that's trying to undermine their tried and true traditions that had existed, you know, for as long as anyone, of course, can remember. Last thing I want to talk to you about, of course, is popular culture. And we've brought up a couple of, you know, a bad movie, maybe some fictionalized accounts of things going on, and really not much going on. There's plenty of gangster movies. You know, we all love gangster movies. I loved Boardwalk Empire. You know, what a great TV show that was. But in terms of popular culture, not much has been done on Phoenix City. Mm-hmm. Why is that, maybe? And, you know, what's going on with the future in terms of popular culture here?
Well, there is this really terrible B movie that I'd actually encourage you all to watch it. It's just called The Phoenix City Story. It was done by Phil Carlson in 1955, just a year after he was actually filming it on location in Phoenix City before anyone had been arrested for the murder. So not a lot of time elapses between the actual event and the film. And Carlson also is well known for making Kansas City Confidential. So this is something that's kind of in his wheelhouse. But there's really been nothing since then, in large part, I think, because this story was just sort of buried and forgotten. That served the interests of people like John Patterson, too, who wanted to put away the people who had killed his father, but also didn't want this example of white crime didn't really comport with people's ideas of what should be causing them anxiety in terms of crime in the post-war period. So really nothing, yeah, there hasn't been anything else, but my book project has been optioned for a television series. Yay. It's still in the, it's very exciting. It's still in the early stages, so I don't have any details to share about it really, but we are at the pitch has been written, and it's sort of winding its way through the Hollywood machine that, as best I can tell as an outsider and non-expert on this, it moves very, very slowly.
Yes, but it does. I can assure you of that as someone who lives in the middle of it. it definitely moves very slowly. That's for sure. But still, it's a cool thing that has been optioned, and when this does, you know, become a series down the road, I'm looking forward to watching it for sure. See, so those of you out here thinking of a career as a historian, you know, there's all kinds of avenues to travel down, right? You write a story that's compelling enough, you find a story that nobody knows about, and hey, you know, next thing you know, you got a TV series. Isn't that rad?
it's really an exciting thing to think about. And you and I were talking a little earlier before we started recording about just the ways that historians are doing history too. And it's exciting to find any form, whether it's just a different style of writing a book or other forms of media, you know, a podcast, to get people interested in these stories and to I hope inspire historians to think about different kinds of stories that they can tell and different ways that they can tell those stories too. So what's most exciting to me about the prospect of the television series is just, you know, getting other people to think about these issues of not just a kind of a scandalous story that's weird and exciting. I'm not going for the Southern Gothic kind of thing. Like, here's this weird story about Southern Alabama, but more, you know, this was really not that out of the ordinary. And these are really normal, decent people who got, you know, tangled up in, some of them anyway, some of them not so decent, but were normal people who got tangled up in this really extraordinary story. And it does tell us something, I hope, about our present day crisis in criminal justice system.
I think so. And you know, what you're going to do here, of course, is add a layer of complexity onto something that people think they already understand, which is always a good thing to do. And you know, and as somebody who's I consider myself sort of a social media guy, I'm on there all the time. I see these bad takes constantly. You know, people like just sort of glomming on to whatever uncomplicated talking point to support, you know, their political agenda. It gets to me to be, you know, a little annoying. I much prefer the complex and the nuanced story to the others. And this seems to be one of those. And so I'm very excited for the forthcoming book. I will most certainly be singing its praises when it finally comes out. And then, you know, down the road when the TV show is done, I'll be happy about that too. Before I let you go, you're on Twitter, right?
Yes.
Okay. What's your handle there, so we can make sure everybody goes?
At Tammy Ingram.
Okay. And anywhere else we can find you on the internet?
You can also find me on the usual social media sites, though Twitter is my preferred place, especially for professional stuff. But that's it. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, that's where we'll find you for sure. And Tammy, I thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Well, thank you so much, Keith, for having me. I really enjoyed it.
You better believe it. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care.
So let me take a sec to tell you all about an exciting project I've got going on at Keith Harris History. I've transcribed and podcasted a series of letters written by Confederate prisoner of war Henry A. Allen. Allen was an officer in the 9th Virginia Infantry who was captured at Gettysburg at the Bloody Angle, the culmination of the Pickett-Pettigrew assault on July 3, 1863. He served in various prisoner of war camps for the duration of the war. During this time, he wrote often to his wife Sarah, back in Portsmouth, Virginia, discussing the day-to-day life in Union prisons and his many thoughts on the war, his marriage and children, and life as a prisoner. I am currently annotating these letters to fill in the missing information and provide links to useful resources concerning Allen in particular and the prisoner of war experience in general. This is an ongoing process where I'll be adding new information and revising my commentary as my research on the topic develops. So please go to keithharrishistory.com, click on the podcast tab, and have a listen to the Civil War letters of Henry A. Allen. From there, you can explore all kinds of resources and book suggestions that will help enrich your understanding of Union prisons and Confederate prisoners.